Good evening, I think we can get started. My name is Steve Anderlies, I'm a professor of engineering here at Calvin. I teach particularly in the computer engineering area, and so I've been asked to introduce our speaker for this evening. I first met Derek Sherman at a Christian engineering education conference some years ago, and I quickly grew to appreciate his humble spirit, his curiosity, asking good questions, and some keen insights on a number of areas that I had been thinking about as well. Derek worked in industry for several years and then later completed his PhD in electrical engineering at McMaster's University in the area of robotics and computer vision. He is the author of a recent book which explores a Christian perspective of computer technology entitled Shaping a Digital World, Faith, Culture, and Computer Technology, published by InterVarsity Press. Just happens that I got my latest Reformed Journal Perspectives and was leafing through it, and here there's a review of his book, a very nice positive review there. So if you get that journal, you might want to check that out. I myself went through his book, and you can find the review that I did of that book on the online version of Books and Culture, also a positive review. Derek is currently an associate professor of computer science and chair of computer science, mathematics, and physics departments at Redeemer University College in Ancaster, Ontario. His lecture tonight is titled Shaping a Digital World, Connecting Bytes and Beliefs. He'll be presenting some of the ideas from his book, arguing that computer technology is not neutral, but it's value-laden with substantial legal, ethical, social, cultural, and faith implications. Your assignment is to think of some good questions. I think he's willing to entertain some of those at the end here, so I'll be thinking about what you might want to ask him to go through his lecture. Would you please join me in welcoming Derek?
All right, good evening. Thank you so much for coming out and for your interest in this topic. It's an honor to speak here at Calvin College. I'm grateful for Calvin and the work that happens at Calvin as a sister college of Redeemer. And I'm also a benefactor of some of the scholarship that's come out of here. And in particular, I'd like to note the book Responsible Technology. And I think we have one of its contributors here, Ari Lieblatter. And so I'm very grateful for that book. 30 years later, it's been still a helpful resource. And it's perhaps one of the most cited books in my book. As a one-person department at Redeemer University College, I consider the computer science folks here my virtual colleagues, and I'm very grateful to them. A few of them are here tonight, and it makes me feel like at least I have some colleagues, grateful for that. And I'm also grateful to the Communitas program for your hospitality and for the opportunity to work here for 2 weeks. I'm here as a visiting scholar. And I'm working with Steve Anderlies. We have a shared interest in the area of faith and technology, and we're doing work on engineering and faith. And so I'm grateful to be here. All right. One of the first questions I open with in my book is, an old one from Tertullian. What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? And this is the age-old problem, right? Athens, the city of culture, and so on, and Jerusalem symbolizing faith. What do these two things have to do together? And in fact, this is the job of a Christian college, right? To find ways to connect our faith with all kinds of different disciplines. And one can update this question and say, what does Silicon Valley have to do with Jerusalem? What does all these new digital devices that surround us and have shaped our lives in so many different ways, does faith have anything to say to us about them? Or is there anything that we can learn from the ancient Christian faith that helps us navigate these new areas? And in a nutshell, what do bytes have to do with beliefs? If you look at a computer program, can you actually discern the Christian commitments of the programmer? And if you can't, does it make any difference? And so there's lots of questions that come up with this. And of course, our job as Christian computer scientists and engineers is to tackle this. And in fact, if there is no connection, then what is the purpose of a computer science program in a Christian college anyway? So I hope to kind of dig into this a little bit, and then we can have a discussion afterwards. Before we go too far, I thought I would do a very, very quick philosophy 101. I have to preface that by saying using the words of Donald Knuth, when it comes to philosophy, I'm a user and not a developer. So a lot of the stuff that I've benefited from, I've been through others, and I stand on their shoulders. But very, very quickly, two sort of extreme views of technology, if you will, include technological determinism, which is this notion that technology is an autonomous force, sort of beyond our control. It just sort of steamrolls us, and we're hapless in its wake. Think of the Borg on Star Trek. Resistance is futile. And then the other category or approach that we sometimes see is instrumentalism, technological instrumentalism, to be more precise. And basically that states that, you know, technology is just a tool. Every technical artifact is neutral. And if that's the case, then really there is no responsibility in terms of the engineer or the computer scientist. We make tools, we're tool makers, and it's up to the person to use it well. And we have no responsibility, in a sense, if instrumentalism is in fact true. But I would like to argue, as many have, and the book Responsible Technology makes abundantly clear, that technology is value-laden. Now, perhaps this is a little bit risky, but I'm going to start with a few examples. And the first example is one that maybe is not wise for a Canadian to bring up in an American context, but the AK-47 assault rifle, and it's low-hanging fruit. I mean, in terms of talking about the neutrality of technology, it's value. It has a bias. The AK-47 is not a neutral tool. It's true, there is objective intentionality and subjective intentionality, and you can talk about some of the specifics there, but the gun is not designed for squirrel hunting. It's designed to kill lots of people very quickly, and the world with AK-47s is a different world than the world without assault rifles, and it has a bias, and its bias is to assault. Perhaps a more seemingly benign example is the automobile, right? It's just a way of getting from A to B. Well, on my way here, I had to walk across the Beltline at the stoplights, and you, as a pedestrian, begin to quickly realize that the car has fundamentally shaped our landscape, changed the way we live. It's separated where we work and where we worship and so on from where we live. Its effects go far beyond just getting us from point A to point B. It is a device with a bias. Another one that perhaps we haven't thought about too much is one that Neil Postman also mentions, is the mechanical clock. Now, how does the mechanical clock have a bias? Well, our lives are different because of clocks. Neil Postman talks about clocks being invented by Benedictine monks to regulate prayer time. But what they had done is they invented a device that quantizes time, and its product is seconds and minutes, and it basically regulates all aspects of our life. Commerce, when we eat, our culture, our work is regulated by the clock. It has a bias, and it changes things. And what I've found very, very helpful is to look at this concept of value-ladenness and connect it to the concept that Al Walters talks about in his book, Creation Regained, the notion of structure and direction. So our cultural artifacts, including our technology, has a bias. It has a structure. It's based on the possibilities, the latent potential in creation for making artifacts of that sort. But it also has a direction. It can be directed towards things that reflect God's will and his intents for his creation, or it can be directed in ways that reduce flourishing and reduce shalom. And I found really, really helpful people who've been writing about this decades ago, folks like Jacques Ellul and Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman, decades before the arrival of the digital revolution, talked about the non-neutrality of technology, that it's in fact value-laden. Neil Postman, who I think actually spoke here at Calvin College a number of years ago, writes, "Embedded in every tool is an ideological bias, a predisposition to construct the world as one thing rather than another, to value one thing over another, to amplify one sense or skill or attitude more loudly than another. It has a bias. is value laden. And the user is, yeah, biased by the direction of the tool. You can, of course, use a tool for all kinds of different purposes, but the bias that's built into it affects the user. It amplifies one sense or skill more loudly than another. John Culkin summarizes Marshall McLuhan's writings by saying, we shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us. So our tools, it's kind of like a loop. We make these tools, but these tools have a way of shaping the way we live and work. And of course, there's Marshall McLuhan's famous phrase, the medium is the message. And I never quite understood that until more recently. What do you mean the medium is the message? It's almost kind of like a Zen-like saying. But what it is saying is that the medium, the media, technology itself has a message. It has a way of seeing the world, or it has a bias. It has it includes values that shape us beyond a particular technology. McLuhan actually talked about the medium being like a juicy piece of meat that's carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. So as we're watching television or surfing the net, we're consuming the sort of content, but we're unaware sometimes that really what's happening, we're being sculpted by the medium and the technology itself. Technology is not neutral. I'm reminded also of Psalm 115 that talks about idolatry and how those who make them will be like the idols and technology when it becomes an idol, and when we don't use it in normative ways can change us. And of course, there's a whole bunch of people who've been writing about this, people not necessarily working from a Christian perspective, but are looking at what we would call creation and looking at what's happening. And there's a whole bunch of books recently that have come out that are observing that this technology is not neutral, that it's changing us. iBrain, written by a neuroscientist, Gary Small, writes that we're being plunged into a state of continuous partial attention. And he's beginning to observe that this is changing the way we think. In fact, in his book, he talks about how he's even seeing some changes in the brain itself as a neuroscientist. This playful title, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, is an article by Nicholas Carr, who went on to write a book called The Shallows afterwards, which is an excellent book to read, in my opinion. But in his article in The Atlantic magazine, he talks about how his mind is being changed by the technology. My mind now expects to take in information the way the net distributes it in a swiftly moving stream of particles. Once I was a scuba diver in a sea of words. Now I zip along the surface like a guy on a jet ski. That's what Nicholas Carr is. And in his book, he adds, you know, we are turning into pancake people, spread wide and thin as we connect with a vast network of information. I think Nicholas Carr is a very thoughtful writer, and I think that some of his points that he makes in his writings are helpful to think about. And again, they point to the fact that technology changes us, that it's value-laden. And of course, there's a whole variety of other magazines, articles, journal articles that one can point to. Sherry Turkle is another person who, again, spoke here at Calvin College. You've had some excellent speakers here. Someone who recently wrote the book Alone Together, who's looking at the effects of technology and social networking and so on, but also sociable robotics and how we begin to expect more from technology and less from each other, as the subtitle of her book says. So digital technology is not neutral. And of course, here there's articles about narcissism and how it affects youth, but the articles are manifold. So there's two helpful questions that I think that we can ask. Once we've accepted the fact that technology is value-laden, how do we proceed? Well, there's two helpful questions to start with, at least, and these are questions that Andy Crouch proposes in his book, Culture Making. When we look at cultural artifacts, to kind of ask the question, what does it make possible? I mean, this is the question that's usually answered by marketing and by others. You know, what new nifty things can we do? What do we gain? But the other question that we often don't think about too much is, what do we lose, or what becomes more difficult? And I think, in the words of Neil Postman, we have to be careful not to be one-eyed prophets, just to see if just the good or just the bad, but to consider both of these things. What becomes impossible or at least more difficult, what might we lose? All right, so there's different approaches to technology, even that Christians have had over the years, and different traditions. And these are based very, very, very loosely on Niebuhr's Christ and culture sort of categories, but you know, you can have rejection of technology. And some of the writers in this, I used to kind of shrug and laugh when I looked at this, but there are some very thoughtful people, people like Wendell Berry, others talk about these sorts of things, it's not to be rejected completely out of hand. They have some arguments, they have some points that are valid, but I think as Christians, and we'll talk about this in a moment, we see technology obviously as part of the good potential in God's creation. There could be an indifference to technology. We can go a whole hog the other direction and just completely embrace the technology in an unthinking kind of way. And of course, the posture that I'd like to suggest, and one that is made in responsible technology, is cultivating responsible technology. And what does that mean? How do we do that? Here's a definition that I suggest for computer technology, which, if you can read the fine print, is based very heavily on the definition of technology suggested in the book Responsible Technology. But I define computer technology as a distinct cultural activity. Andy Crouch defines culture as what we make of the world, and certainly our digital technology is a big part of what we make of our world. In which human beings exercise both freedom and responsibility. Both of these things sort of go together. I heard once that, I think it was Viktor Frankl, once wrote that the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast of America ought to be balanced with a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. These two things go together. It's not just about liberty. It's also about responsibility. And I think he has a point. And in fact, there are some people who started a design for what a Statue of Responsibility might look like with similar dimensions and so on. But did these two go together? God made us able to respond, and so we have a responsibility. We have this freedom, but with that comes responsibility. And of course, the rest of the definition, to unfold the hardware and software possibilities and creation with the aid of tools and procedures for practical ends or purposes. Based heavily on the responsible technology definition and updated for computer technology. Okay, so the question is, how do we use the Bible? Of course, if the Bible is our lamp unto our feet and our guide for grateful living, how then do we approach new paths? How does this lamp light our feet when we're going down new paths, when we are faced with the digital world and we try to discern what it means to be a faithful Christian? What can we do? And of course, I'd like to suggest looking at biblical themes. And of course, this is the bread and butter of Calvin College. So I feel a little sheepish even mentioning this here. This is something that any Calvin College student will be able to articulate, I'm sure, after a Calvin College undergraduate education. But this whole notion that the Bible, we can't just pick out proof texts, especially technology and computers, you won't find any reference to a technology or a computer in a Bible dictionary or in a Bible dictionary or concordance. So what do we do? How do we use the scriptures? Well, it's this grand narrative of God about his creation and about how somewhere near the beginning the human family messed things up, and how in the fullness of time Jesus Christ came to make to inaugurate his kingdom here on earth. And that one day God is going to return and make things, restore everything. It's that big narrative that we live within and shapes everything that we see and everything that we do. And this is the bread and butter of, I'm sure, people at Cal College and also at Redeemer College. But the challenge, I think, this is a very helpful starting point, is to drill down and say, okay, how then shall we engineer? How then shall we compute? We've got this idea of the world. We have a lens, a pair of spectacles, if you will, of scripture, as John Calvin wrote, that help us to see the world more clearly. But then what do we do next? What are the implications for that? I like the analogy that my colleague Al Walters gives of that of an automobile. He says that the Bible is represented by the engine, and then the area, disciplinary areas, engineering, computer science, others, as the wheels. Now, you normally don't connect wheels directly to an engine. There's usually some sort of transmission in between. And in Christian scholarship, the transmission can be provided by a Christian worldview, by this Christian understanding of the world, and that's based on a biblical framework and guided by biblical themes and by biblical norms. And it is that Christian worldview that facilitates the connecting the light of Scripture, the engine, if you will, to all areas of study where the wheels or the rubber hits the road, if you will. And I think that's a really good analogy. But let's look at each of these areas. Let's start with creation. What are the implications of creation, on our digital technology? Well, let's look at a few things. Computer technology is part of the latent potential in creation. What does that mean? Well, we need a big view of creation. Creation is not just stars and seas and birds and trees. Certainly it's that. But it's also all of the things that God has ordained to exist, all the latent potential in creation, including technology and culture, cuisine and music, and so on. Furthermore, we're given a cultural mandate. We are called to fill the earth and subdue it. And what are we to fill it with? Well, all of the possibilities. It doesn't mean just filling it with people. It's filling it with all the possibilities in creation. God created humankind in his image, male and female. We have a responsibility. And we image our creator by being creative. And of course, the way that we understand the true image of God is to look at the person and life of Jesus Christ. And of course, the whole notion of being created in God's image has distinct implications for how we see humans. We're different than machines. We're different than artificial intelligence programs. We are distinct. The creation of humankind is a very distinct story in the Bible. And there's implications. We have to avoid reductionistic views about what it means to be human. We also have to remember that we're not gods. We are simply images of God. There's all kinds of implications. God also, in the creation story, establishes a pattern of Sabbath rest. And I think this is something that we need to rediscover sometimes in our busy, hectic lives. Our machines never stop. And we've said already that our machines shape us. And I think perhaps part of the hectic lives that we all lead and the constant connection and the state of being and the continuous state of partial attention has to do with how these machines changes. And I think the notion of Sabbath is something we learn already, built into the fabric of creation from the beginning, something that we need to appreciate as. Creation also, just very briefly, has limits, laws, and norms. Limits. There are certainly limits in computing, and I could ask any one of my computer science colleagues here to rattle off a few. The halting problem, right? Is a known limit in computing. The intractability of certain things, the traveling salesman problem. These are all things that sort of define our limits in the area of computer science. The speed of light appears to be a limit in creation. There are limits. There are laws. Laws are basically what define the regular order of things. In computer science, we have De Morgan's Law, and Andel's Law, Shannon's Law, laws describing the operation of semiconductors, and so on. And that's part of creation. But in addition to laws, like the law of gravity and so on, there are also norms. And norms are basically God's order for culture and society and personal relationships. These are areas in which humans distinctly exercise freedom and responsibility. We can't choose to ignore the law of gravity. But we can have a normative approach to our social relationships, or we can choose to have an anti-normative approach. We can choose to honor justice, or we can be sources of injustice. These are areas in which human beings distinctly exercise responsibility, and these areas also come into play when we're working with our technology. We'll talk more about that later. I like this quote, which I think is familiar to my computer science colleagues. Frederick P. Brooks is a famous computer scientist. respected computer scientist. He's also a Christian. And he wrote in one of his books this delightful quote, "Why is programming fun? What delights me as practitioner expect as his reward? First is the sheer joy of making things. As the child delights in his mud pie, so the adult enjoys making things, especially things of his own design. I think this delight must be an image of God's delight in making things, a delight shown in the distinctiveness and newness of each leaf and each snowflake." We image God, and we can delight in being creative. In computer science, we can delight in elegant algorithms, programming pearls, beautiful code, nice, pleasing user interfaces, the wonders of pattern and data sets, and so on. We can delight in beauty, we can delight in computing. Well, that's not where things end. As I mentioned, somewhere near the beginning, the human family fell, and this had implications for all of creation. The Bible talks about the thorns and the thistles affecting our work. Romans 8 talks about the whole creation has been groaning. The fall of humankind affected all of creation. And this brings up interesting questions. How did the fall affect computing in particular? In a perfect world, would cables be free of noise and components free of decay? Is that part of a broken world, or is that part of the pristine order of creation? And Joel Adams wrote a paper asking some of these questions too. I think it's necessarily a matter of speculation. We really can't know what a pristine creation might have been like. But what we do know is that God gives us freedom and responsibility in terms of the normative choices that we make. And there we can see clearly how sin can affect our cultural activities in particular. Technology that's misdirected. And I'm sure you could think of many examples of that. The spoiling of shalom. The other important point is that sin cannot create anything. Al Walters talks about this in Creation Again. Sin is like a parasite that attaches itself to God's good creation, structure and direction. It takes God's good creation and perverts it and distorts it. And we see that also in technology. And related to that is the human heart some of the effects of sin there. We see already very early on in the human story, Genesis 11, story of the Tower of Babel, how people put a trust in themselves to build a tower to bridge them to heaven, to make a name for themselves. And of course, whenever we put our trust in technology or other types of artifacts or in anything in creation, we make an idol. And the word that's also used in responsible technology for putting our trust in technology is technicism. The secularized faith in technology is savior or rescuer of the human condition. And this trust you can see in lots of places. We live in a postmodern world, but modernism is still evident in many places. To save everything, click. Here's a book that talks a bit about the optimistic view about technology, infinite progress. The notion that eventually technology will solve ignorance, disease, poverty, hunger, war. This is a form of idolatry, looking to created things rather than the creator. John Calvin writes that our heart is a perpetual factory of idols, and I think technology is one of the idols of our times. And I think what we need to do instead of putting our trust in technology is to remember that we are creatures. We can't save ourselves. Even our technology has fallen. An interesting related sort of topic is the whole, what's been sometimes termed, the rapture of the geeks. Basically, people in computing, some very clever people, in fact, are predicting that one day, within 30 years or so, we'll be able to build computers that can perfectly replicate or produce greater than human intelligence. And basically, that will begin an era of rapid progress, and the human era will begin to end. And basically, that will allow us to download our brains into a computer and live in a virtual paradise of sorts, and in essence, gain a type of immortality. I find Andy Crouch's writings helpful on this. He talks about how idols make two promises. Many idols make two promises. You shall be like God, and two, you shall not surely die. And we see this also in the world of technology, as people put their trust in technological solutions, also when it comes to the problem of death and mortality. And of course, the whole notion that you could just plug into a computer and download your person into a computer has presuppositions about what it means to be human. If all we are is the stuff that we're made up of, then if we could perfectly simulate all the neural activity in the brain, then we could perhaps live forever in a computer. It has a reductionistic view of what it means to be human, embedded within this philosophy. Another related ism is informationism, and Quentin Schultz writes about that in part. A faith in the collection and dissemination of information is a route to social progress and personal happiness. And here I have a quote from Nicholas Negroponte, who's with the MIT Media Lab. And basically he says, a new generation is emerging from the digital landscape, free of the many old prejudices. Digital technology can be a natural force drawing people into greater world harmony. We see almost religious language being used when we're referring to the possibilities. And I think we see some of those things also appearing in education and in other places. But this is not new. We talked about the Tower of Babel already. But the dawn of electricity, here's a quote from Nikola Tesla. He writes, it will become next to impossible to contract disease, germs, or get hurt in the city. Humanity will be united, wars will be made impossible, and peace will reign supreme with electricity. Now, to be sure, electricity has improved our lives, but it's when you put this trust in these technologies to solve the human condition that things become an idol. And of course, when the telegraph came, we saw similar writings about how, you know, once we connected the world with telegraph lines, we'd be able to communicate and it would foster more understanding, and there would no longer be any hostilities, there'd be an end of war. A popular slogan at the time of the telegraph was that we would, once we wired the world, we would be able to make muskets into candlesticks. There would be peace once we were able to communicate. We know that's not true. And I put that little page up on the slide here to show some of these 1950s kind of optimistic views of technology, how television will benefit your children. Motorola leader in television shows how TV will mean better behavior at home and better marks in school. And that's the claim. And of course we see too, again, right, these sort of same repeating patterns, the laptop promise. If you buy a laptop, you will, so on and so on. I downloaded it from that website. So we see this kind of informationism creeping into lots of different areas, and very optimistic, over-optimistic thinking about technology. Well, related to the fall is the whole question of, is technology in fact a result of the fall? That's a very interesting question. You know, without the fall, we wouldn't need medicine, perhaps we wouldn't need clothes, we wouldn't need arms, we wouldn't need a whole bunch of things. So in fact, is technology just a result of the fall? Here's some quotes from an essay by Jacques Ellul, where he writes, you know, in this garden state, no cultivation was necessary, no care to add, no grafting, no labor, no anxiety. Creation spontaneously gave what man needed. And elsewhere in that essay, he writes, thus, no matter what attitude one takes toward technique, which is his word for technology and efficiency and so on, it can only be perceived as a phenomenon of the fall. It has nothing to do with the order of creation. Now, I think we need to balance a strong notion of what creation is, that creation was built good, that all these possibilities of creation were good. They're fallen, but they were created good, and we ought not to reject them. And I should be careful not to draw a caricature of Jacques Ellul. I know he was a dialectic writer, and I'm still trying to understand him. But these quotes, I think, are very interesting points for discussions with students and so on. It's interesting to hear what people think. But the creation is affected by sin like a parasite of God's good creation. It doesn't mean the creation is bad and all the possibilities in creation. It just means it's been distorted, it's been perverted. And of course, in the fullness of time, Jesus Christ came. And I love the passage in Colossians where we see repeated again and again, all things, that all things were created through him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile to himself all things. And so what we see is that the all of creation is distorted by sin, but Christ's reconciliation is more than a match for that. And the scope of creation is more than a match for the harmful effects of sin. And that in Christ all things are being reconciled. And I like this quote from Gordon Spivey, who I think was a professor here, if I'm not mistaken. Nothing matters but the kingdom, but because of the kingdom, everything matters. This all things also applies to our technology, our cultural activities, our cultural artifacts, and that's something we need to keep in mind. And then as Christians, as faithful kingdom workers, we're called to be agents of shalom, to bring flourishing, discerning biblical norms and creational norms as they apply to our work, and to help help give shape to that. Well, how do we do that? How do we discern normative ways to unfold culture and technology? And this is where I've benefited again greatly from some of the writings in Responsible Technology by Egbert Sherman and by others who have discerned some what they call design norms, creational norms, biblical norms that I think are very, very helpful to keep in mind as we go about our task in a world of technology. So I'll go through them briefly. Cultural appropriateness is one norm that we need to keep in mind. Design ought to fit the culture in which it is introduced. It should alleviate burdens, preserve what is good. Technology and international development is one area where we need to think about this, but also the culture, the school room, and the church, and so on. What is appropriate? And we need to be sensitive to that. In technology, we think about backwards compatibility, new standards, file formats, and so on. All of these issues are places in which we exercise choices and freedom and also responsibility. Communication norms, open communication, has to do with transparency. And in the world of computing, we think about manuals and documentation and protocols and programming languages. There's norms there also in terms of how we communicate. Social norms, courtesy, politeness, and in web speak we might say netiquette, issues in social networking. Genuine communication requires bodies, is what Brad Kallenberg writes, and I think that when we look at our social interactions, we need to think carefully about the role of social networking. Sociable robotics, child minding robots, elder care robots. What are norms for these sorts of areas? Stewardship is an important norm and an important biblical norm. This is not only dealing with money, of course, but has to do with the environment, human resources. When we think about computing, we think about issues in e-waste, sustainability, green computing efforts that have begun. And of course, what we see is that the consequences that happen when we absolutize one area, the economic area, like in the Dilbert comic strips, you see with things are all about profit, but other things start to fall apart. Profit should be made, of course, in connection with service to God and neighbor. Aesthetic norms, these are also important. This captures the notion of delightful harmony. I like how Wolterstorff writes about this. He talks about a spade, and he says, a good spade is good for digging and good and satisfying to use for this purpose. So it's not only good for what it does, but it's also satisfying to use. Maybe you use software that wasn't so satisfying to use, and you know what I'm talking about. Form and function should be in harmony. And these apply to GUIs, graphical user interfaces, human-computer interaction, dashboards, and so on. Randy Pausch, who was a computer scientist in Pittsburgh, writes in one of his books about VCRs and how it used to take, one of those old VCRs that always had the flashing 12 on the front that very many people had trouble, setting the time for because of the convoluted user interface. He takes it into his classroom and takes a sledgehammer and just hits it. and then makes a point to his students, don't make stuff like this. I like that example. And of course, when it comes to computers, the design of computers, the Mac G4 Cube is actually in the Museum of Modern Art in New York for its design. And coding, there's the notion of, you know, poor code, spaghetti code, versus, you know, beautiful code and beautiful circuit layout and wiring. All of these things have aesthetic aspects to it. Justice is another important biblical norm, a fundamental one, I would say. And when we apply that to computing, we think about respecting the rights of all users, respecting privacy, intellectual property, copyrights, issues of justice in the digital divide, piracy and personal information, GPS and RFID tags, software piracy, patents, copyrights, digital rights management systems, end-user license agreements, open source software, and so on. All of these issues are related to the justice aspect, the juridical norm. Caring norm, showing love and care for our neighbors, including workers, customers, assistive technologies that actually help people who are disabled. Doing things because we ought to, not just because we can. Roboethics is a whole area, talking about what are useful and appropriate uses of robots. And I've done some talking about, you know, the whole notion of robot warriors. And there's people doing work on lethal autonomous robots. And what are the ethical implications of that? All kinds of caring norms that have to do with our design and use of technology. Areas like video games. What is the responsibility of a programmer, the types of video games he or she makes, and so on. There's lots of implications for the caring norm. The trust norm has to do with dependability, reliability. Can you count on a device? And of course, ultimately, it has to do where we put our ultimate faith when we talk about technicism. You know, do we put our faith in God, or are we putting our faith and trust in technology? And then I'll add another one. This is based on writings by Steve Anderlies and Gail Hermer on the need for humility. This isn't included in responsible technology, but I think they make a convincing case that the whole notion of humility is a distinct kind of norm, a posture that designers ought to have, an understanding about the unintended effects of technology and being watchful for that, and especially in safety critical applications, thinking. Not being overconfident in our designs. So these are a list of norms that I think are helpful. They don't give simple answers that just fall out, but they point, I think, a very, very helpful direction forward when we're wrestling with technology, also as designers and computer scientists. And whenever we go against these norms, there are consequences. That's the way creation is made. It's like rubber bands. We can push against these things, but eventually creation pushes back, and I think we can see that. I like this quote by H.H. Farmer. If you go against the grain of the universe, you get splinters. And I think as engineers, we need to realize that, and to realize that ultimately the meaning of technology is service to God. All right, I want to leave some time for questions, but I want to wrap up with just the last biblical theme, creation, fall, redemption, we've talked briefly about, and there's much more we could say about that, but let's look at some eschatological implications. The notion of restoration, what does that mean about our technology? And I think if we look at technology in general, we see two common viewpoints that sort of emerge. There are the optimists who trust in technology and progress, and we've talked about technicism already. There's even people who use a kind of religious language. Michael Benedict writes about the image of the heavenly city being actually a religious vision of cyberspace, this utopian view. It's a type of post-millennialism, actually, you know, seeing that we can usher in a utopia once we achieve a certain technological mastery. And then, of course, there's the pessimists, and we see lots of examples of this in modern science fiction movies, and this postmodern view of technology that views it with despair. You know, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Battlestar Galactica, Terminator, iRobot, The Matrix. These are films that show a dark future where our technology turns on us and the consequences that come with it. Maybe some of you will recognize the Wired cover there. That's a well-known article, often cited, by Bill Joy, who's a clever computer scientist, and he wrote an essay called "The Future Doesn't Need Us." And basically he talks about how technologies like robotics and genetic engineering and nanotechnology are going to destroy us ultimately. And so there are the pessimists as well. But we need to steer a balanced view, and I'll talk about a biblical view in a moment. The end of the world, we know, will not be ushered in by technical progress, and neither will it be determined by rogue technology that may appear in the future. The Bible tells us that the coming of the kingdom is tied to the proclamation of the gospel, and we're called to be faithful in the meantime. So what can we say about computer technology in the future? And I like talking about this with my students, you know. I think there's this beautiful scriptural picture of a garden city. So we start with a garden, and we end with a city, a new heaven and a new earth. And everything will be made new. And at the end of time, things are not going to be simply annihilated, and some big sky book's going to come down and just pull us out of here. But the Bible talks about how our cultural artifacts, too, will be purified in this cosmic crucible, that they will somehow, in some form, be present in the new heavens and the new earth, too. I like the book by Richard Mao, you know, When the Kings Come Marching In, where he talks about Isaiah 60. And he talks about how the riches of the nations will be brought into the city of Zion. Camels, precious metals, lumber, even the ships of Tarshish will be there. The ships of Tarshish being a symbol of pagan commercial power. And all of them will be there for the glory of the Lord. What will that look like? Will there be computers in the new heaven and the new earth? If the ships of Tarshish will be there, why not computers? Why not other artifacts that we will recognize? I ask my students sometimes this question. I said, do you think there'll be computers in heaven? And this always creates an interesting dialogue. Some will say, nah, I don't think so. And others will say, I don't know. And then I ask the question, well, will there be harps in heaven? Oh, yeah, there'll be harps in heaven. Pipe organs? Yeah, probably. These two are cultural artifacts. And so we have an interesting discussion. Playfully, I suggest that Linux will be the operating system, but that's a matter of perhaps too much speculation. But I think this underscores, again, the need for humility. We really don't know what the new heavens and the new earth are going to be like. We, of course, see through a glass darkly. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see some of these cultural artifacts in the new heavens and the new earth. All the possibilities of the good creation that God made will be restored and will be free of sin. And it's hard to think about what that would look like, but I think we'll recognize some of the things that are there. I like the words of Lewis Smedes, who writes that our calling is to go into the world to make some imperfect models of the perfect world to come. Our computing activities and our engineering activities also have value, and we need to strive for some imperfect models of the perfect world to come. I like this the image in Scripture from Micah. Micah 4, they will beat their spears into pruning hooks and their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. So what we see here is that same image of structure and direction, right? That the swords and the spears that are misdirected towards harm and towards warfare will be brought into the new heaven and the new earth. But they'll be transformed, they'll be purified, and they'll be redirected towards tasks like taking care of a garden, and pruning, and working in God's creation. That these artifacts will be there, but they will be redirected. The structure and direction notion is embedded in that, I think. And that's a helpful image. And other technology, too, will be redirected and purified. Now, finally, I'd like to end with one other thing. Just a quick note. As I mentioned, I've benefited a lot from the Christian scholarship here at Calvin College, and I think it's very interesting to think also connecting the ideas of how technology shapes us, how obedience is the message, with some of Jamie Smith's writings about how our heart is shaped by habits and rituals. And, of course, our technology has significant forming power, I would say. Our habits and our rituals with our tools shape us. And I think that Jamie's work with Desire in the Kingdom and Imagining the Kingdom talks about the importance of habits and rituals. And I think that's another way we can see how technology shapes us. And we need to be cognizant of these digital liturgies that we're building into our lives, into our schools, into our churches. And the question then is, if technology shapes us, and if we're building liturgies and habits with our technology, what is the responsibility of computer scientists and engineers who create these devices? How do we think about these things? What's the role of spiritual disciplines, taking technology's habits on occasion to help us return to what we're called to be? How do we use technology in such a way that we become more like the people that God wants us to be? And I like these words from Frederick Brooks again. He's the computer scientist I quoted at the beginning. But he talks about the importance of the heart. And he says, if we would have our creations be true, beautiful, and good, we have to attend to our hearts. And I think that's a fitting place to stop. So thank you very much. And I have a list of references here that I found helpful. It's just a small one. And a lot of the content that I had from this talk was taken from the book Shaping the Digital World, which you see there. But I'm willing to take questions if people have questions. And